Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to celebrity memoirs, news, business, and self-development. Every month, members get one credit to pick any title, plus two Audible originals from a monthly selection, and access to daily news digests from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, as well as guided meditation programs. Between a full-time job in IT and a full-time job in podcasting, it gets harder and harder to sit down and read the books I'm interested in. This is where Audible comes in. I can listen on my daily commute, relaxing, or while out running errands and still get in the books I have been wanting to get into. You can download titles and listen offline anytime, anywhere. The app is free and can be installed on all smartphones and tablets. Now you can try Audible risk-free with a special 30-day free trial by visiting audibletrial.com/nerderyandmurdery. That's audibletrial.com/nerderyandmurdery. Don't let your busy life get in the way of that great book you've been wanting to read. Go get your free trial of Audible today. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. This is Jeffrey, and we've talked about many times before that I experience problems and struggles with my mental health. And really, without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is therapy does work. It's helped for me, but what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships at work, or you're not dealing well with stress. Whatever you need, it's really time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles, and it's time to start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is a customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. So join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And there's a special offer to Nerdery and Murdery listeners. You can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/nerderyandmurdery. That's betterhelp.com/nerderyandmurdery. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast.
You're listening to the sweet, sensual, and serendipitous sounds of Nerdery and Murdery.
Zig, damn it. Welcome to episode 87 of Nerdery and Murdery.
Big 87. I'm Zig with your Nerdery.
And I'm Jeffrey with your Murdery. Welcome to another week of the highs and the lows and the nerd and the murd. I'm sure Zig is excited to have another nerdery subject to talk about today. So Zig, with that, I will let you take over on the nerdery side of the house.
Excellent. Today for episode 87, we're going to discuss the fifth Doctor. That would be Peter Davison.
Fifth Doctor of Doctor Who.
Yes. Who is also coincidentally the father-in-law of the 10th and 14th Doctor.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. He is David Tennant's father-in-law.
Which is about all I know about this Doctor.
Yeah. Okay. So they got a bunch of TV writers for Doctor Who during Peter Davison's tenure. But they also kind of wanted to harken it back to the first Doctor a little bit. So it kind of walks a weird line. Now, this Doctor is, again, my friend Angela, is her favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had various discussions about this over the years. Again, I think the writing was a little off, but there are some episodes for Peter Davison that are exceptional. Earthshock, where one of the characters actually dies, one mm-hmm. of the companions. Time Flight, Four to Doomsday. There's some really, really good episodes. The Black Orchid, which is one of the episodes they wanted to harken back to. So in the original series, Doctor Who was originally a children's program that was supposed to teach children about history and science. They stopped doing the history, the largely historical episodes where there wasn't a science fiction or fantasy element, and it was just a straight historical document. They actually did one of these during Peter Davison's run. It was called Black Orchid, and it takes place in Edwardian times and just concerns basically like a mystery going on, which is what the other historical episodes were back during the first Doctor, William Hartnell. But they quit doing those after Hartnell left and didn't do another one until, again, this one. And they haven't, I don't think they've done one since, which is a shame because some of this stuff is, they're pretty interesting. Black Orchid is a really great episode if you haven't seen it. A lot of great costuming, good sets, things like of that nature. But overall, the Fifth Doctor is an incarnation of Doctor Who, the protagonist of the BBC science fiction television series Doctor Who. And he was portrayed by Peter Davison. It concerns a centuries-old Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey who travels in time and space in a TARDIS, a time and relative dimension in space, frequently with companions. And at the end of the life of their life, the Doctor regenerates, and as a result, the physical appearance and personality of the Doctor changes. Davidson's portrayal of the Fifth Doctor is having a vulnerable side and a tendency towards indecisiveness. He was dressed as a boyish Edwardian cricketer, and he traveled with a host of companions, including the boy genius Adric, Matthew Waterhouse, alien aristocrat Nyssa, played by Sarah Sutton, and Australian flight attendant Tegan Javanka, played by Janet Fielding, whom he had traveled alongside in the previous incarnation. He also starred in later adventures alongside devious schoolboy Vizsla Turlough, played by Mark Strickson, and American college student Perry Brown, played by Nicola Bryant. So Peter Davison started out life as Peter Malcolm Gordon Moffat. He was born in 1951 in April, or April 13th, that he's known professionally as Peter Davison. He's an English actor with many credits in television dramas and sitcoms. He made his television acting debut in 1975 and became famous in 1978 as Tristan Farnan in the BBC's television adaptation of James Herriot's All Creatures Great and Small. Peter Davison was really the first big name actor they had. Like, everybody else was known as character actors and they did other stuff, but he was actually famous when he became Doctor Who, you know, as playing Tristan Farnan, because All Creatures Great and Small was huge in England. It was pretty big over here too. Davidson's subsequent starring roles included the sitcom Holding the Fort, Sink or Swim, of course, the aforementioned Doctor Who, Dr. Stephen Dacre in A Very Peculiar Practice, which ran from 86 to 88, Albert Campion in the Campion series from 89 to 90. He also played David Braithwaite in At Home with the Braithwaites, Dangerous Davies in The Last Detective, and Henry Sharp in Law and Order UK. His first television work was a 1975 episode of the children's science fiction television program, The Tomorrow People, alongside American actress Sandra Dickinson, whom he married on the 26th of December, 1978. Davidson portrayed an alien named Elmer who arrived on Earth alongside his sister, played by Dickinson, and his mother, known as Mama, played by Margaret Burt. In the mid-70s, during a lull in his acting career, Davidson spent 18 months working in a tax office in Twickenham. In 1976, he was offered a prominent role in the 13-part TV series Love for Lydia opposite Jeremy Irons. The series was broadcast on ITV the following year. So, Peter Moffat had to take the stage name Peter Davison because there was already a Peter Moffat on the rolls. He basically just made the name up on the spot. But he kept it as his actual name, which is why the actress Georgia Moffat goes by that name, because that's her name. She is also an actress. Her mother was Sandra Dickinson. Sandra Dickinson was mostly known for the television adaptation of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. She was Trillian. Peter Davison is also in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He's the cow that tells them that he wants to
be cut. Okay.
Yeah. So that's actually the first time a lot of people have seen him, but you can't tell it's him because he's made up.
Right.
So in 78, Davidson's performance as a youthfully mischievous Tristan Farnan in All Creatures Great and Small made him a household name. He said, "I don't know how much of it changed my life. It creeps up on you, really. You become used to it quickly. I think I wasn't aware of it suddenly changing my life, although I had a bit more money to spend on rubbish. I bought a house, but the money was rubbish because I was a BBC newcomer. Though nobody's money was really good except probably Robert Hardy's. I remember after the third series, I bought a car, which was a Renault 18, and I thought it was pretty flash. And I went to this garage to fill up with petrol, and a guy said, 'Hey, aren't you that bloke off the Vet set?' I said, 'Yes, I was.' And he said, 'Why are you driving this piece of shit?'" But while he was making All Creatures Great and Small, he split up with Sandra, and he married for the second time in December of 78. And because they had basically had to live in the Dales, but Sandra Dickinson wanted to stay in London because he was up there filming All Creatures Great and Small. Davidson was absent for 24 episodes in the second run of the series, including the majority of the series 5 and 6, due to other acting commitments, i.e. Doctor Who. And he missed the second half of series 5 because of a very peculiar practice, and he missed series 6 because he was doing Campion. You know, in a lull in season 3 of All Creatures Great and Small, the BBC cast him as the Fifth Doctor. He was first seen in the last episode of Logopolis, which was broadcast on the 21st of March, 1981. Davidson played the role through the 19th and 20th seasons of Doctor Who, which included the 20th anniversary special, The Five Doctors. Patrick Troughton, who had played the Second Doctor, reportedly advised Davidson to move on from the role after 3 years to avoid becoming typecast. In acting on this advice, Davidson informed producer John Nathan Turner that he would leave after the 21st season. In a break from recent tradition, John Nathan Turner decided to regenerate the Doctor in the season's penultimate story. So Peter Davidson didn't get a full 3 seasons. Peter Davidson got 2 full seasons and almost all but the last serial of his 3rd season. So Davidson's last regular appearance as the 5th Doctor was the last episode of The Case of Androzani, broadcast on the 16th of March, 1984. The Caves of the Androzani is one of the best 1980s Doctor Who episodes, full stop. They actually started putting a little money into the series, and it's dark. It's filmed in these passageways and these caves. And it's just really good. I was really impressed by it. I did not realize when I was watching it, it was his last episode. He did return to the role briefly in 1983 charity special, Dimensions in Time, which we've spoken about before. But beginning in 1999, he recorded a series of Doctor Who radio dramas for Big Finish Productions. In 2007, Davidson, at the age of 56, appeared alongside 10th Doctor David Tennant in a Doctor Who special for Children in Need, written by Stephen Moffat and titled Time Crash. Images of the Fifth Doctor are shown alongside other incarnations in the episode The Next Doctor and The 11th Hour. He also appears in The Day of the Doctor via archival clips. The Fifth Doctor has also appeared in officially licensed novels, short stories, and comics. So as we said before, the Fourth Doctor was seriously injured after falling from the Pharos Project radio telescope and merged with a future incarnation of himself called the Watcher and regenerated into his new youthful fifth incarnation. The regeneration was difficult and nearly failed, with the Doctor briefly taking on personality aspects from his previous four incarnations. After recovering in the fictional city Castrovalva, which was actually a trap created by the Master, he continued his travels with Adric, Tegan, and Nyssa. Initially, he traveled centered on getting Tegan back to Heathrow Airport in time for her first day as a flight attendant. But the TARDIS repeatedly missed the destination, and Tegan eventually decided to stay in the TARDIS. After trips to the future and the past, encountered villains such as the Monarch and the Mara. The Fifth Doctor was confronted with tragedy when Adric died trying to stop a space freighter from crashing into prehistoric Earth in Earthshock. I want to talk a little bit about Peter Davidson's outfit. So Peter Davidson was an avid cricketer and an avid fan of cricketing. He always liked the Edwardian style outfits that the cricketers wore. So he told them, I'd like to be dressed as a cricketer, you know, with like a Panama hat and, you know, run around that way because it fits my youthful persona because he was at the time the youngest person to ever play the Doctor. It was all usually played by men well into their 40s. But he was, I want to say like 34 when he played it. And he held that title as the youngest man to play the character until Matt Smith. Matt Smith stepped in, I want to say like 22. Matt Smith was very young. But yeah, he was sort of the youthful Doctor. He did end up getting to meet some of the older companions as time went on. But yeah, I'm sorry. Circling back, talking about his outfit as the cricketer. He was really into cricket. And the Edwardian look for cricketing. So he told them that's what he wanted to do. So they went in and designed a cricketing outfit based on that idea. And they presented it to him and he was like, well, that's totally wrong. That's not it at all. That's not what a cricketer would look like. It would be something more like this. And they're like, well, we already spent the money on the costume. So here you go. And he's like, why does it have a piece of celery on it? Oh, we just thought it'd be funny. And they eventually explain that in the writing that he keeps the piece of celery in his lapel because it turns purple when certain gases from a certain spectrum appear, and in a pinch, you can always eat the celery. But yeah, so he was kind of odd looking as the Doctor, but that outfit kind of grows on you. I will say this, the outfit got destroyed because when he regenerated into, Colin Baker at the end of Caves of Androzani, Colin Baker wakes up and is in that outfit. And as he's going and changing his outfit, it kind of gets ripped and other stuff going on. And plus they had to let it out because Colin Baker is larger, broader shouldered than Peter Davidson was, even though they're about the same height. So they had to kind of tear the jacket up a little bit. So when he did the Children in Need episode with David Tennant, they had to remake the outfit, which is why it looks like it fits better in that episode. The hat is the same, from what I understand. But so following Adric's death, the TARDIS accidentally arrives at Heathrow Airport, which is where they were supposed to drop Tegan off at. Here, the Doctor and Nyssa leave Tegan, assuming she would want to stay, when in fact she did not. The Doctor and Nyssa then travel together for an unspecified amount of time before the renegade Time Lord Omega attempts to return to our universe. Temporarily bonded himself to the Doctor in the series Arc of Infinity. This is the next time you see the Time Lords. They actually faced with this threat, the Time Lords were forced to attempt executing the Doctor, but he eventually tracks Omega down to Amsterdam, where he defeats him and re-encounters Tegan, who, having now lost her job, has no second thoughts about joining the TARDIS crew. So they drop Tegan off at Heathrow Airport for her first day, but it turns out it's like a year and a half later. So she lost her job. And it's at this point that the Doctor meets a new companion, an alien boy stranded on Earth by the name of Vizsla Terlo. The Doctor at the time did not know that Terlo had been commissioned by the Black Guardian to kill him. Terlo is actually an assassin sent by the Black Guardian to kill the Fifth Doctor. Nyssa then left to help cure Lazar's disease on a space station called Terminus. But then they meet these entities known as the Eternals, racing in a yacht-like spacecraft for the prize of enlightenment. Terlo was able to break free from the Black Guardian's influence, and he continued to travel with the Doctor and Tegan. It turns out that Terlo was not an English schoolboy. Terlo was actually from another planet that got taken over by a fascist faction, and most of his father's people and where they're from were either exterminated or exiled. So Terlo, because he was a kid, they didn't execute him, but they sent him to live on Earth because he looks like Earthlings. In like the 1920s. So he's having to live as a schoolboy in the English 1920s, but he's from a very advanced spacefaring civilization. So he really wants to get away anyway. So the Black Guardian offers him the help, so he takes it. And at the time, he didn't know who the Doctor was, so he thought he was a bad guy. They continue to travel. It was just the Doctor and Tegan at this point. And they landed in the reign of King John for the King's Demons. The crew again encounters a master who's using a shape-shifting robot called Chameleon to impersonate the king. Now, the unit Chameleon was actually a robot, an actual real life robot designed by this one guy. And he was the only one that knew how to operate it, make it work, because he would pre-program it and it would move and speak and everything else. So when you hear Chameleon talk, that's actually a voice synthesizer inside that robot. However, the guy died, so they only used Chameleon for the King's Demons, and again in Planet of Fire in the Caves of the Androzani. But in the Caves of the Androzani, Chameleon just sort of self-destructs because no one knew how to fix it. The Doctor was able to meet three of his previous incarnations during the Five Doctor series. Tom Baker decided he didn't want to do it because he'd only quit a couple of years earlier, but they used some episodes from Shada. And after further adventures in which the Doctor re-encounters old foes, including the Silurians and the Sea Devils from Warriors of the Deep, both Tegan and Terlo leave the TARDIS. Tegan would find the death and violence they encountered on the travel was too much to bear. And in Resurrection of the Daleks, and Terlo returned to his home planet of Trion in the company of his younger brother, as well as other exiles from Trion from the planet Sarn in the episode Planet of Fire. Planet of Fire is also a really good episode. Planet of Fire and Caves of the Androzani, I think, are his two best, even though they're his last two. Warriors of the Deep, where they meet the Sea Devils and the Silurians, is not as good because the special effects budget, they ran out of money that season. So the Mara, it's supposed to be this horrible, awful, terrible, scary looking monster, that gets on board this this undersea base looks like a Chinese dragon. You know, like you see in the streets where it's basically a big puppet with five or six people under it with a head at the front and a, yeah, that's what the Mara looks like in this. And it is, it's awful. It really takes you out of the episode because the sets are pretty good. The Silurians look okay. The Sea Devils look okay. But when they come up against the Mara, honestly, I think if they didn't have the money, they should have just written the Mara out. It's just not good. We talked about Planet of Fire. So at the end of Caves of Vandrazani, the Fifth Doctor and his last companion, Perry Brown, were exposed to the drug Spectrox. It's a deadly, toxic, raw form on Androzani Minor. With only one dose of the antidote available, the Doctor sacrifices his own existence to save his new companion, Perry. Expressing doubt for the first time that regeneration might not be possible this time, he regenerates into the Sixth Doctor. When he regenerates into the Sixth Doctor kind of goes crazy and tries to kill Perry. In the episode, The Twin Dilemma. He kind of comes out of it after that, but I want to say that Peter Davidson suffered from, I think, the same thing that Jodie Whittaker suffered from. And it, the writing, when it was on, it was really good. But when it was off, it was not good at all.
Yeah, and I haven't enjoyed the writing for the Jodie Whittaker at all.
Yeah, Jodie Whittaker is great as the Doctor.
Agreed.
But the writing is just piss poor.
Right.
And, you know, that's not on her. She did the best of what she had. She even had some good companions.
Yeah, I think so as well. So, you know, it, knowing that the writing was bad for the Peter Davison one, I don't think this is going to be one I'm going to be watching.
Well, like I said, there are a few that are really just exceptional. But for the most part, it's pretty bad. I'd say watch the last two. You can tell they started to get better writers, but they also had the producer, John Nathan Turner, became the head producer. And I think that dude, as much as he was associated with Doctor Who for so long, I think his input hurt the series more than it helped it. And I think he's basically the reason why it got taken off the air. Some of the decisions he made. In hindsight, I could say that, but at the time, they didn't look like bad decisions. You know what I mean? He was trying his level-headed best, but he wasn't getting it. I don't think that dude really understood what he had. And it wasn't until after his death that they started trying to bring it back. So, you know, good or bad, John Nathan Turner, I don't think he helped Doctor Who. I think he hurt it. And you know, since he's been gone, it's blossomed into something amazing, international, that everybody watches now. Whereas before, it wasn't. You know, everybody in England watched it, but not that many people watched it over here. So, yeah, that about wraps it up for Peter Davison. I just kind of wanted to go through his period of time and explain the costumes. Mm-hmm. And again, talk about the poor writing and some of the poor effects that they had. And it was just that they had to reconnoiter some of how they were spending their money, which they did a lot better job with Colin Baker. And they did a much better job when Sylvester McCoy took over. It was like, oh, again, like shooting a bullet and throwing it. But yeah, Peter Davison was, he always said that he had some Tom Baker backlash. But again, I don't think that was so much that people were comparing him unfavorably to Tom Baker. I think the writing was just not as good, you know, because there's a season, I think it's season 17 of Tom Baker, which is not considered to be the poorest season of Doctor Who ever. And again, for the same reason, the writing wasn't good. They were having trouble they were having trouble making their ideas known. But yeah, that's about it for Peter Davison. He is not my doctor. And the first time I saw him, I was a little shocked to see him, but I didn't dislike him as a doctor. Again, he's really good at it. He was younger, a little less self-assured, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, he was still the smartest guy in the room. He wasn't as confident as some of the rest of them, right, which is what Jodie Whittaker kind of played off on too. And I think it was a good idea. It was a good choice. They just need better, scripts.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause where they're, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and I don't think I've seen a single episode of Peter Davidson. So, I mean, I recognize him. I recognize when it was, when he was playing it, but I don't think I've seen a single episode.
Yeah. He's Planet of Fire and Caves of the Androzani. Mm-hmm. If you don't watch any of them, watch one of those or both of those. And again, he's not bad. He's actually a really good doctor. The two episodes, Planet of Fire and Caves of the Androzani, they were well executed. They were well written. The acting was good and the special effects were pretty sweet. There's a character called Syl, which shows up, which is a slug-like creature. Awesome. Just awesome. Love Syl. Syl's one of my favorite characters. He comes back in a Colin Baker episode later on. But yeah, basically they're an amphibious species and he looks it. So yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Cave of Fire and or Planet of Fire and Caves of the Androzani.
Overall, not high recommendations for this doctor, but no. You think there are some episodes.
Yes, there are definitely those two episodes are great. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are hit or miss. If you were looking for a historical piece, much akin to the first doctor, Black Orchid, you can't go wrong with. It's pretty good. But yeah, you could probably chuck the rest of them.
Interesting.
Yep.
Not what I figured your take on this was going to be. So that's interesting to hear.
Yeah. Well, it's just, again, they hired a bunch of TV writers.
Yeah. All right. Then with that, I guess we'll step over to the murdery side of the house.
Murder.
Today, I got my information off All That's Interesting, Wikipedia, Encyclopedia of Arkansas, Clark Prosecutor, and Medium, and this is the story of Ronald Gene Simmons, not of Kiss fame.
Right on. Ronald Gene Simmons.
Yes.
That Gene Simmons' name is actually what, Hiram?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. Hiram, you got me on that one. Hiram? Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, on December 22nd, 1987, Ronald Gene Simmons began a killing spree that would be the worst mass murder in Arkansas history and the worst crime involving one family in the history of the country.
What?
His rampage ended on December 28th, 1987, leaving dead 14 members of his immediate family and two former co-workers.
Good God.
Unlike the more sensational, civil, reputable type of family annihilator like John List, Simmons is more the common type, the livid coercive, a domineering domestic abuser who is threatened by losing control over his family. For Simmons, slaughtering his family was more about his need to possess them rather than to spare them from humiliation or poverty. And in fact, he made sure his family lived in crushing poverty and isolation. So in Arkansas on December 28th, 1987, retired military serviceman Ronald Gene Simmons walked into a law firm and fatally shot a secretary. He then went on to an oil company, a convenience store, and lastly, his former workplace at the Woodline Motor Freight where shots were also fired. The whole rampage took 45 minutes. When it was over, Simmons had killed two people and wounded four others. After fatally shooting office manager Joyce Butts in the Woodline Motor Freight, Simmons then surrendered to a secretary there. He said, quote, "I've gotten everybody who wanted to hurt me." He waited there for the police, and when they arrived, he handed over his gun without any resistance. He was sentenced to death 16 times, and after refusing to appeal his sentence, he was executed in Arkansas on June 25th, 1990.
Wow.
But at that point, the most ghastly of the crimes Simmons committed had yet to be discovered and was already days old. When the police couldn't reach the Simmons family, two officers drove to the isolated home in the foothills of the Ozarks, and it was there, next to wrapped gifts below an ornamented Christmas tree, that the corpse of 12 Simmons family members lay. Each was covered with a coat. Later, deputies found Simmons' two toddler grandsons wrapped in plastic sheeting and hidden in abandoned cars parked nearby, and investigators realized that Simmons had begun his killing spree with his own family nearly a week before.
Good God.
So Ronald Gene Simmons was born in 1940 in Chicago. After his dad, William Simmons, died of a stroke in 1943, his mom, Loretta Simmons, remarried within a year to a man named William Griffin, who worked for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In 1946, the Corps moved Griffin to Little Rock, Arkansas, the first of several transfers that would take the family across the Arkansas over Central Arkansas over the next decade.
Did he have a stutter?
Didn't say. That's interesting.
Well, okay, so I've heard this happens, but I'm not 100% sure. Like, if you're kind of young and you move from one part of the country where they speak one way and you move to a different part of the country where they speak a different way, especially mm-hmm. when you're learning how to master languages,
mm-hmm.
that can trigger a stutter.
It's interesting. No, it didn't say. Yeah, sorry.
If it happens before you're like 8 or 9, doesn't happen. You just develop whatever locality you're in.
Interesting.
But if it happens before that, you know, when you're first learning language skills, mm-hmm. that it can trigger a stutter.
Hmm. No, didn't know that. It didn't say.
Okay.
When he was in the second grade, his family moved to the small town of Hector, Arkansas, into an old farmhouse without running water, 20 miles away from the nearest paved road. They lived there for several years, and to Simmons, it was paradise. For the rest of his life, he longed to return to Arkansas and live the quote, simple life. Simmons showed narcissistic controlling tendencies early on, hitting his younger siblings, manipulating them and his parents, erupting in fits of rage and never backing down or admitting he was wrong. His younger brother described him as a bully and a tyrant. In 1957, Simmons dropped out of school and joined the U.S. Navy. And while stationed in Washington, he met Bursaby Rebecca Becky Ulibarri. Sorry, I tripped across that name. The two would marry in 1960 in New Mexico. And Becky was the kind of woman Simmons wanted. She was meek, accommodating, independent. She couldn't even drive. Simmons ran the household with an iron fist even when he was away. He had set schedules for meals, laundry, and cleaning. He controlled the finances, paying the bills himself and only allowing Becky a small allowance, which was usually not enough to cover decent meals for his ever-growing family. Yet meek cowed Becky in her diaries and letters, called him my Gene, and when she expressed frustration with his tyrannical ways, told herself that he probably knew what was best. Simmons then left the Navy a few years later to join the U.S. Air Force, and over the next 18 years, Simmons and Ulibarri had 7 kids together.
Good night.
Well, in 1977, Becky's obstetrician diagnosed an underlying health issue that meant another pregnancy would put her life in danger. He recommended in strong terms that Becky get a tubal ligation. But this being 1977, her husband also had to consent to the procedure, which he did not. Becky pleaded with him, literally begging for her life, until finally Gene begrudgingly relented, and after that he was never the same towards her. He never forgave her for putting her own life and her children's well-being over his wishes, and he stopped having sex with her, and in his mind, she was no use to him anymore.
Wow.
By the time Simmons retired in 1979, he had accumulated several awards for his military service. He had received the Bronze Star Medal, the Republic of Vietnam Gallantry Cross, and the Air Force Ribbon for excellent marksmanship. Simmons retired from the Air Force and military service on November 30th, 1979, with the rank of Master Sergeant, but the Simmons weren't one big happy family, as we alluded to. Unbeknownst to Becky, they weren't actually poor. Gene was just stingy. After finishing his stint with the Navy, Gene worked briefly at a bank, which paid quite well. However, his know-it-all attitude and controlling personality chafed his coworkers and supervisors, effectively shutting him out of any promotions. Simmons was also well-known in this town, which was Cloudcroft, New Mexico. He was someone people feared. Quote, he had a beer in his hand all the time. He had one little room he would stay in all the time. It was dark and seemed spooky, and it stunk. In 1981, allegations surfaced that Simmons had been sexually abusing his 17-year-old daughter, Sheila, and that she had fathered a child with him. From the time she was born in October of 1963, it was clear she was his favorite. And it was about in 1978 or 79, Simmons began actively grooming Sheila. While his other children had to beg for money for school supplies and lunches, Simmons lavished Sheila with gifts of clothing and jewelry. For his other children, he only had criticism, demands, and insults, but Sheila was his little princess, his, quote, ladybug. By March of 1981, Sheila was pregnant with her father's child, and after dropping her off at prom, Simmons gathered the family and told them Sheila was pregnant. While he didn't state who the father was, Becky knew. Simmons laid down the law as usual, commanding the family to accept the child and raise it as one of their own. Becky dropped into a deep depression, but she said and did nothing against her husband. The Department of Human Services in New Mexico launched an investigation, and fearing arrest, Simmons fled New Mexico in late 81 with his family, first to Ward, Arkansas in Lenoke County, and then to Pope County near Dover, Arkansas in the summer of 1983. While in Ward, Simmons impregnated Sheila again, but this time, despite his proclaimed pro-life beliefs, he obtained a secret abortion for her. They wound up on a large tract of land known as Mockingbird Hill in Dover, Arkansas. The property was desolate, isolated, with no phone and no plumbing, and was surrounded by a tall makeshift fence. Simmons worked a string of low-paying jobs in the nearby town of Russellville, Arkansas. He quit a position as an accounts receivable clerk at the Woodline Motor Freight after numerous reports of inappropriate sexual advances, and went to work at Sinclair Mini Mart for approximately a year and a half before quitting on December 18th, 1987. So places we're going to see later.
Well, okay. So, and he retired after 20 as a chief master sergeant?
As a master sergeant, yes.
That was it back in the late 70s, early 80s. That was a pretty good paying retirement, if I'm not mistaken.
It should have been.
Yeah.
It really should have been. Yeah.
I mean, I get wanting to have a second income, but that should have been able to cover, you know, that should have been able to cover most of it. I don't know. I mean, seven kids is a lot. So.
Well, and especially in the remote location they were in.
Oh, yeah.
It should have paid for everything.
Mm-hmm.
The remote location did forebode the kind of parent Simmons was, harsh and exacting. As in New Mexico, Gene had grand dreams of turning his overgrown rocky acreage into a self-sufficient farm, which, again, on the master sergeant's salary, should have covered all that.
Yeah.
But as in New Mexico, he worked his children hard to make his fantasies real. Their final task before their death was to dig a 4-foot-deep ditch in the yard, which Simmons told them this was for an outhouse, but it would be a grave for half of them. Right before Christmas of 1987, Ronald Gene Simmons decided to kill his whole family. His reasoning had never been made clear, but in the years following the tragedy, there have been several speculations. One theory was that Simmons had learned his wife was secretly planning a divorce, which drove him into a murderous rage. Quote, I don't want to live the rest of my life with Dad. I am a prisoner here, and the kids too. Becky had written to their son shortly before their murders. Every time I think of freedom, I want out as soon as possible. Other theories included spurned advances of love from his own daughter, Sheila, who eventually left home to marry. It's speculated that the secretary Simmons murdered at the law firm had also spurned his romantic gestures, which led to her demise. On the morning of December 22nd, Simmons shot his wife and his oldest son using a .22 caliber pistol. After that, he savagely strangled his three-year-old granddaughter. Simmons then waited for the other four kids who were living at home at the time to return, and when they did arrive, he told them he had presents for them. He killed all of them in the same way, one at a time, by strangling them and holding them underwater in a rain barrel.
Goodness.
On December 26th, the remaining members of the family showed up for the annual Christmas visit, and when Simmons' son Billy and his wife Renata got there, he shot them both dead before strangling their 20-month-old son. He did the same to his oldest daughter, Sheila, and her husband and child. And the last victim was Simmons' 21-month-year-old grandson, Michael. Mm. Simmons dumped seven of his family members in the backyard and left the rest in the house, covering their corpses with coats. Then Ronald Gene Simmons went to drink at a local bar. When he returned home, he watched TV and drank beer surrounded by the dead bodies of his family. The spree continued on the morning of December 28th when, driving to the nearby town of Russellville, he killed the 24-year-old secretary Kathy Kendrick at the office of Peel and Eddy Law Firm, shooting her four times in the head. Next was the Taylor Oil Company, where he shot owner Rusty Taylor, who actually survived this, and employee Jim Chafin, who died on the spot. Frightened workers at the oil company had already called police while Simmons was on his way to his third destination, the Sinclair Mini Mart, where he used to work. And there he shot two employees who survived. His last stop was to another former workplace, the Woodline Motor Freight, where he shot Joyce Butts. And he had said to the secretary that he surrendered to, "I just wanted to kill Joyce, just Joyce." Ronald Gene Simmons was in cell at a local detention center when police showed up to his Dover home to find the bodies of his family. Simmons was sent to the Arkansas State Hospital in Little Rock for a competency evaluation, where staff psychiatrist Dr. Irving Kuo found him sane and capable of standing trial, and Simmons was charged with a total of 16 counts of murder. During the trial for the murder of his family, when prosecuting attorney John Bynum presented a note that Gene had written to Sheila professing his love, Simmons lashed out at Bynum, punching him in the face and trying to grab a deputy's handgun, and officers had to rush him out of the courtroom in chains. Simmons had two trials. Yeah, I know, exactly, right?
There must be a separate legal definition.
Simmons ended up having two trials. After the first one, he was convicted on May 12, 1998 for the deaths of Kendrick and Chafin. And 2 days later, Simmons was sentenced to death by lethal injection plus 147 years, which he did not appeal. He was sentenced to death by lethal injection plus 147 years.
Just in case the lethal injection didn't work. Just in case he came back as a zombie. He's still got to be in jail.
It was the then governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, who actually signed Simmons' execution warrant. In the second trial that concluded on February 10th, 1980.
I have to. Yeah, fuck that guy. Sorry.
In the second trial that concluded on February 10th, 1989, Simmons was also found guilty of 14 counts of capital murder for the deaths of his family members. Simmons was consequently to be lethally injected on March 16, 1989, and in his final trial hearing, he said, quote, "In my particular case, anything short of death would be cruel and unusual punishment." Simmons had chosen lethal injection himself as the method of execution, and while on death row, he had to be separated from other prisoners as his life was being threatened constantly. This was, yeah. Well, this was actually because he refused to appeal his death sentence. The other prisoners believed Simmons was damaging their chances of beating their own death sentences.
Oh, wow.
John Harris, one of Simmons's first defense attorneys, said, quote, "He was ready to die. He was at peace with it, and he wanted it." He also said, I think he felt like they're going to take him out. He's going to take them out first. I think that was his mindset. But Harris also said there was more than one person to blame. if the authorities had successfully arrested him back in 1981 on the basis of abusing his daughter, then the murders most likely wouldn't have happened. Prosecutors at the time said they dropped the charges at the family's request, and nobody ever came to claim the body of Ronald Gene Simmons, so he ended up being buried in a common grave. And that is the story of Ronald Gene Simmons.
Nice.
Yeah, well,
thank you for that.
Not nice.
Not nice. Well, the I don't know. That was an interesting story. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, fuck that guy. never fun, happy stories with mine.
Wow. Yeah. Kind of glad that guy's not in society anymore. But yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, they're totally right. Why didn't they just, you know, they had him in 1981.
Yeah.
They had him dead to rights.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Well, the family requested that no charges be pressed, so.
Daughter or the mom?
It didn't say. Yeah, it didn't say.
I guarantee you there were members of that family going, oh no, he needs to go down for this. This guy's a piece of crap.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you taking that journey with me. Thanks for the Doctor Who trip.
You're welcome.
That'll take us to the end of another recording week. As always, you can find our information on nerderymurdery.com. You can find our contact information, where if you wish to tell us things you want to hear, things you don't want to hear, we have people that tell us stuff all the time. So we really appreciate each and every one of you for that.
We also have a YouTube page, Nerdery and Murdery. You can go and see playlists for every episode, as well as little videos that we like and things we think are fun.
Yeah, outstanding. Zig's been doing a really good job on the videos on TikTok and YouTube and Facebook and everything. So definitely check those out.
Thanks, sir.
They pop up on my feed all the time. You can also find the link to our merchandise, where if you wish to show your Nerdery and Murdery fandom, please do check our store there. You can also find the link to our Patreon for if you wish to become a patron. Don't forget, you get episodes early as well as exclusive episodes, and it really does help with keeping us on the air, as there are costs that are involved with this. So please do consider becoming a patron.
Please and thank you.
Please and thank you. And last but not least, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review anywhere you can. It helps us and helps others find our content that may be looking for us. So with that,
I have been Zig with your Nerdery.
And I'm Jeffrey with your Murdery.
Cue the music.